Hello, Bob.
Hello, Ben. Great to be back. Been a while. Ready for the new millennium or the new decade?
Yeah. Now, we usually talk. That's how we communicate. But occasionally, we do send each other emails. And you sent me a lump of McLuhan, which you've not done before. It was a paragraph of Marshall McLuhan. And I found it very interesting. And I wanted you to read it out to our listeners now. And then, so as a basis for our discussion.
Right. McLuhan often talked about the group mind that took over under electric conditions, as opposed to the individualist framework in the Gutenberg literary phase 100 years ago. So over the 20th century, he called this group mind the emotion of multitude, and he got the phrase from W.B. Yeats. And he would quote this occasionally in articles in the 70s, because he could jump off from it into more up-to-date things. So the quote from Yeats is looking at French plays, and he finds a problem with French plays. I don't know what era, but France. Okay, he says, "I have been thinking a good deal about plays lately, and I have been wondering why I dislike the clear and logical construction which seems necessary if one is to succeed on the modern stage." Do you have any idea about this quote, when it could have been, Ben?
From Yeats. No,
but when? You're not sure. Like the modern, could be the 1920s, could be the 30s, could be the teens, right?
Yeah.
Somewhere in the first few decades of the 20th century. So he's talking about the modern stage and how to succeed. It came into my head the other day that this construction, the clear and logical construction, which all the world has learnt from France, is everything of high literature except, big letters, the emotion of multitude. So he explains the emotion of multitude, what he means by that phrase. The Greek drama has got the emotion of the multitude from its chorus, which called up famous sorrows, even all the gods and all heroes, to witness, as it were, some well-ordered fable, some action separated, but for this form, all but itself. The French play delights in the well-ordered fable, but by leaving out the chorus, it has created an art where poetry and imagination, always the children of far-off multitudinous things, must of necessity grow less important than the mere will. And then there's a dot, dot, dot. There's a few words that are not included here. And then the next sentence. The Shakespearean drama gets the emotion of multitude out of the subplot, which copies the main plot, much as a shadow upon the wall copies one's body in the firelight. We think of King Lear less as the history of one man and his sorrows than as the history of a whole evil time. Lear's shadow is in Gloucester, who also has ungrateful children, and the mind goes on imagining other shadows, shadow beyond shadow, till it has pictured the world. McLuhan often, that's the end of what we have here, which I got off the web, McLuhan often include a few more sentences. But
hang on, I'm in a bit of confusion about whether that was Yeats or McLuhan. That's all Yeats, right, okay.
Yeah.
But McLuhan decided to emphasize it. He decided to quote it.
Yes, he said that under electric conditions, the emotion of multitude becomes gargantuan. And it's probably because we have the industrial media, the literate industrial media, parallel to the new electric media. So the parallel of one familiar industrial environment with this new parallel to this new environment that creates the interval and the drama between the main plot and the subplot. And so McLuhan, in his figure ground analysis, would say today the subplot is the old industrial situation and the main plot is the new electric inflation, new electric effect. So the interplay between the old industrial environment and the new electric environment creates a global emotion of multitude beyond the emotion of multitude created by a Shakespearean play or a French play or a Greek drama. In other words, in the global theater, we were experiencing the emotion of multitude on a colossal scale. You see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, this is a theme really for both of us, isn't it? That we are very dissatisfied with either a kind of squeaky clean media presentation, a kind of CNN that only admits the media as real. We throw Finnegan's Wake at it. At the same time, we're very dissatisfied with people who think the literary mode is the only mode and only poetry matters, and ignore the fact that they've got tape recorders and televisions and computers and all the rest of it. And we're always sort of battling against the purity of either of those. So this is a very good way of explaining why we find it so fertile to put the two together, or to see both in context.
Right. Now, so I begin in this email, which I titled The Emotion of Multitude. I sent it out to a few people, including you. I say, Marsh McLuhan liked to cite the literary, quote, Emotion of Multitude via W.B. Yeats. So this is the literary, theatrical, literate version of how The Emotion of Multitude is evoked, you know, 100 years ago. So then I had found, Ion had recommended this incredible gospel singer that I knew nothing about, named Vestal Goodman, who passed on in 2003, born in 1929. And I started looking at her clips that he sent me, and they're incredible.
It was in the context of those clips that, for me, the quotation came alive. Without those clips, I'd have found it interesting. I might have had my differences with it, but it was thinking about the emotion of multitudes while I was watching this singer move a huge congregation, a huge concert hall amount of people. And the filming was very good because it didn't only look at her. It was very interested in everybody and how they're emoting, how they're kind of knocked out by the swells in the tune and the moments happening with her voice. And they're singing as well, but you can tell that she's got a microphone, so she's louder than the others. She's kind of leading them. And what's very impressive is her kind of humility as a lead singer. It's very, very different from the pop star with the spotlight on them. She seems to be allowing this stuff to come out and saying, isn't it fantastic this stuff can come out, but I can only do it because you're all here. It seems to be like a communion. And it was fascinating for me because this kind of big gospel event is practically unknown in Britain. The nearest equivalent would be on Sundays on television. We get a thing called Songs of Praise, which is people singing hymns, and it's a term for boredom. Everybody knows it's boring, it's ugly, there's nothing happening in it. But because of my involvement with American popular music, I could understand everything about that singing and what people were feeling. I was completely knocked out technically by what she was doing with her voice, but I could feel it, and I was part of it, watching it, and talking about French plays not having that. I take that as probably in my vocabulary, my Marxist vocabulary, I call that bourgeois drama. When it's all a clash of wills, it's reproducing the bourgeois competition of all against all, and logic and ambition and achievement and so on. Very rational way of looking at the conflict of people, and leaving out the kind of things that Vestal Goodman is bringing up in people.
Yeah, to show you that she's listening to the crowd at the end of this incredible work and leading, she tears up. She's affected by the crowd's response to her, or just the synergistic environment of it. She's just like all those people who were crying and responding to her voice.
That's it. She doesn't seem to be an individual performing in front of them. She's some kind of conduit for everybody to get this stuff out, and then they're all amazed that this stuff, which they thought only moved them or is private, can actually be made public. They're kind of like knocked out. They're stunned that this thing can happen while it's happening.
Yeah, it's you know, what is it? The T.S. Eliot's doctrine of the impersonal or something. Remember, he said it's not the personal voice that he wanted to create in the poem. Which would be the new acoustic emotion of multitude, which is... Are you still there, Ben?
Yeah.
Still,
yeah.
Okay. So I explain. I have the Yeats quote. Then I say, Vestal Goodman evoked the audible tactile emotion of multitude via her metallic female tenor. It's, I guess, not often you have a female tenor, and she's excellent at it. And then I include the next clip where she competes with this young male tenor, and they're both fantastic, and they try to one-up each other by going higher, And eventually, Johnny Cook, the young guy, wins. But did you like that performance?
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot as well. I was interested in because of my own experiences of religion from school, and the few times I've been caught in church because of friends having weddings and things like that. I can report that in Britain, religion is invariably boring. That boredom is considered pious, and the very fact of repression and boredom is what it's all about. So I'm very hostile to religion. I found it an imposition on me whenever I've got near it. This seems to be a completely different mode, a completely different thing going on, and it explains a lot to me the confusions when I talk to people who've experienced this kind of thing from America, who invariably use materialist to mean the business world of competing egos, the French play, and use the word spiritual to mean the collective or doing things for its emotional appeal or its satisfaction to the inner self. And my vocabulary is completely opposite to that because of my experience of spiritual events being so bad. And the thing is, I was very interested in you calling her voice metallic, because there's something about the edge in her voice, which I would call metallic. It seems to rattle like a speaker cone or like something. It has in it the what people learnt through the radio in the 20s and 30s, which goes back to the big camp meetings that happened in the late 18th century and early 19th century, when in America gospel song was invented and it crossed race lines, and they had huge meetings of people, and that's where the African element entered all white gospel. Actually, it has learned from Africa, and this mixture that happened and that came out on the radio in the 20s and 30s, so that everybody knew it, that folk music in America is completely different from folk music's elsewhere in the world, because it had this technical basis, or this technical way of transferring itself. And that metallic element for me is the key to why American popular music has a special place in the development of world music, why people get moved by it and explore it and get obsessed with it, as I have, as a very typical, you know, sort of English music lover. We're all like this. We're all interested in American music. And it seems this metallic thing, it sounds paradoxical, because you're talking about someone who's able to express the emotion of multitudes. So you immediately think of somebody maybe nothing to do with technology, who can just sing in a room. But her singing, this metallic quality, is all about the microphone and all about amplification and electricity.
That's it. That's exactly it. So you have, I want to address the word metallic in a second, but back to this, the audio tactile emotion of multitude that is amplified by the microphone and then broadcast on the TV or the radio. That is the membrane, that's the theater that people are in. It's what McLuhan said, a central nervous system theater, right? So you see the literary view of the emotional multitude is so puny compared to this electric thing. And then McLuhan would extrapolate that's why you've got fascism, totalitarianism, hyperconformity, because everybody's in this emotion of multitude. Now, McLuhan's not pro the multitude or against it. He's saying this is a new kind. So then I was wondering, I saw this footage of the Haitians, or just some newsy thing where they show bodies laying on the street and the earthquake and all. And I said, okay, what is the emotional multitude of there? And I thought, well, it's not audio tactile. I might include that, but I'm going to call it proprioceptive, because the proprioceptive is really what you extend with the chip landscape. TV is more audio tactile, but the proprioceptive, that refers to your senses and your sense of balance. So it was kind of making a pun, because it showed the whole country and its people lost their balance and fell on the ground. And then that evoked a great emotion of multitude. People wanted to prop them back up, so they started having telethons to send them millions. So that was what I called the Android meme, mime's proprioceptive emotion of multitude. So I was trying to show there's different kinds of emotions of multitude. Now back to the metallic.
Well, actually, just a point on Haiti. The point that I noticed on the TV is all the people talking, you know, in authority who are sending the charity seem more frightened of sort of social changes or possibilities of attacks on property or people than anything else. That you got, I mean, here are all these people that have been knocked over and presumably would like help, and yet what everybody seemed to be anxious about was lawlessness, you know, the people grabbing things or doing, you know, taking away the wrong thing. And I saw an absolute property-based paranoia erupting in response to it. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who simply feel upset and, you know, want to help. But when I heard the authorities talking about what they're doing and how they're giving the aid, it seemed to be, yeah, paranoia.
No, that's right. The potential, it's like the Paris Commune or Paris 1968. There's a potential for a new kind of community that the Haitians could create out of whatever happened as they met their needs. And so Clinton and these people ran in and dumped money on it immediately to kind of reestablish the old order. No, that's a good way to look at it. And the okay, back to this metallic thing. I was saying, what was it about her voice?
Well, you were comparing it to male. So maybe we should clarify something a little bit about fascism that you were saying, that we are both saying it's there, whether or not we like it and so on. I mean, I do find it Bessel Goodman singing very different from Hitler over a tannoy, where it's a kind of eruption of anger directed at certain people, which you can emote with if you're feeling your life is under attack, which the petty bourgeoisie of Germany certainly did at the time. But I don't think it's quite possible. I know nothing about Vestal Goodman's politics, but from that area of gospel, you do get people who support fundamentalists and extreme right and so on. And I wouldn't respond to that and immediately say, you know, I'm sure the politics is great, or I'm sure that the politics is bad. But I think the actual, what I'm interested in is my own response, which is hostile to religion, able to relate to it completely because of all the pop music and soul that I've responded to. That you know, the gateway's open for me to respond to it. There's nothing in the way. I'd have had a very good time if I'd been there.
Yeah, me too. So Vestal Goodman and her husband were a traveling singing group and her kids. So it was the Happy Goodman, I think that referred to the husband, or maybe just the general family, but he was Howard Goodman. So they would go around and perform at churches, but they never, and he was an evangelist, but he never preached. They only sang, which is totally the Eastern Plastic dogma.
That's right. We want to reach people via aesthetics, and we think that reaching people via politics or theory has something bullying in it. We find something bullying in the concept, and what we really trust is artistic movement, of what's called artistic from the outside, but which we think is highly political.
That's right. If I could go see Vestal Goodman every week in a church, I'd be there. You know, regardless of what the preacher and them and all the people said. I mean, she is a real spiritual expression, or something that gets you out of yourself, or makes you makes you feel good. And I think it's pretty neat. They understood what they were doing. They were different. They did not preach. They just sang at people, which is what you try to do with your radio show.
Yeah. And I, on my last radio show, I was using the fact that my tape machine was breaking up, and so it was producing my tapes at far too fast. And one of the tapes that was already in the machine was Love Songs by Elvis, and so I was playing these sped up Elvis songs. But it was also making me think about Elvis, and I've always really liked I can't say that. I followed the usual party line of liking early Elvis and despising late Elvis, until I began to realize that I really liked late Elvis. Every time I heard it on a jukebox, my ears would prick up and I'd go, what's that? I like that. And exploring late Elvis is something I'm kind of saving up for my own lateness. There's so much of it. But at the same time, any late Elvis I trip over, I always find the song constructions different, that he was avid at responding to pop music and finding songs. I think it's really interesting he didn't actually write many songs himself. He wasn't a songwriter. But the construction, and I found when you put these love songs next to each other, that each one was differently constructed, that he saw each one as a piece, which reminds me of Frank Zappa. But also that I've the feeling I have when Elvis is singing, I get a Vessel Goodman feeling from him, that his expression is somehow a conduit for this mass world that's possible because of modern media and modern modes of production. And that Elvis was aware of that there's something which people might find religious in Elvis, and he dealt slightly with religion, although in his own Philip K. Dick-like, self-exploring, mystical way. You know, he was very speculative about religion. He loved talking about it. It wasn't like he found one religion and then stuck with it. But that Elvis has this... the reason that cults form around Elvis is that he's doing something which is on the Vessel Goodman side of things, that he wasn't simply being a star.
Exactly. Now, when you talk about... When I was looking at how to describe her voice, I said, this is unique. And I immediately, whatever her sound was, which seemed unique, Ron Rosenbaum, he interviewed Dylan for Playboy around 1978. And in that, Dylan describes the metallic, there's a bunch of other words, but basically metallic nature he was always looking for, and he still was trying to get it. And Ron Rosenbaum, over the last couple of years, Dylan's had a revival. He has criticized for Dylan, criticized him for following his fawning supporters who like what he's doing now. Ron says, you have not recovered the metallic sound. Find that sound. And he keeps going on about this. Yeah. But I thought the metallic point was what I was trying to get at about Vessel Goodman. So then you wrote an interesting thing in response to that. You said, metallic is the word, organic mimicry of the hardware as the true moment of multitudinous communion.
Absolutely, and this is true of Dylan. This is you've made by mentioning Dylan that it was when Dylan was listening to Harry Smith's collection of 78s of old American popular music, and Dylan didn't have a huge knowledge himself, but he learnt it from that collection. He got his repertoire from that collection. This metallic thing he wants is because he wants to sound like the people he heard on those records.
Right, and the hardware, McLuhan would take a broader look and say the actual aesthetic effect of cars and machines in the first half of the 20th century altered people's sensibilities, became something they liked. McLuhan used to point out that European kids don't play with trains and cars, this is back in the 40s and 50s, like Americans do, because for kids growing up in the industrial abundance of America, the birds in nature is the cars and trains around them, and that's where they get their poetic expression, by working with these cars. So if you look at the American rock music, it's turning the hardware world that's being obsolesced by the software world, and the hardware clangings of industry is what's in first slightly jazz, but more in rock, and it's actually a celebration of the American car culture that is the underpinning of Vestal Goodman's style and what you're trying to get here.
It was very perceptive in the film Blue Collar that I can't remember his name now. He's always associated with good film soundtracks. Who came up
Jack Nitzsche?
Yeah, that's right. they got in Captain Beefheart to sing and used a kind of hammering blues for the opening sequence. Beefheart could relate to that music very easily. It's the sound of industry. It's the sound happening throughout.
That's an interesting point.
It's the sound happening throughout China at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So Beefheart is seen as this nature mystic, you know, running around out in the wilderness, and yet his music totally absorbs, and the content of his lyrics is all about the industrial environment around him. See, that's why it requires a more complex imagery than the categories that literacy gives you or the aesthetic priests. They do not deal with the complex situation, and that's what McLuhan was saying. Yeah. Look, there's so many complex sensibilities, what I call four bodies going in here. If you don't notice that, and it doesn't, you do not bring in value judgments, you have to see that the people have become their cars, and you actually say the rhythms of the car back to them, they'll think it's great and dance to it.
Mm. And also not to, one thing that's incredibly destructive and such a break on people expressing themselves is the prejudice that somehow the car is on the side of the false and the modern and the plastic, and then on the other side, if you go for a walk in the countryside, you're somehow really relating. And then people write appalling poems and do appalling pictures, ignoring one half of or 90% of their experience in order to be artistic. And this one's reaction to that, particularly during one's adolescence, this is so false that you develop a kind of anti-nature sensibility, that you, every time nature's mentioned, you hate it because of this false relationship to it. But what Beefheart showed was that because we are natural beings ourselves, our own responses to the car world have nature in them, that nature is in us. It's not this external thing we should go and appreciate outside in unsullied places where humans haven't been, that humans themselves are a natural development.
And that's the aesthetic principle McLuhan gleaned from the radical modernists, and is actually probably the common theme through most avant-garde art of the last 100 years, is to point out that technology is the new nature, and then not say that's good or bad, but say we've got to develop a political relationship to that, or an understanding. That's why McLuhan said that Marx was a little obsolete, because he was not dealing with the changes in sensibilities. And that comes into your problem about how much aesthetics and how much politics. On the aesthetic side, we need to recognize what the avant-garde has been trying to tell us. Now, I was thinking, one good statement in Barry Miles' book on Zappa, the recent book, he says that for him, the rhythms of Zappa's music evoke the rhythms of driving down L.A. highways. Do you remember that line? I thought that was very perceptive. That is, if you think, now you think of the cover of Just Another Band from L.A. where Zappa's in a car with the Turtles and those guys. And then there's that footage he used for G-Spot, I think, or Night School. He showed on TV some footage of Beefheart, you know, in 1960, 61. They go to the Ferris ground. But there's Beefheart driving around in a car. It's like Zappa is featuring the car. And then you have that thing with the monkeys. Isn't he smashing a car up with one of the monkeys in one of the monkey show? This car, it's like Barry Miles may have hit the actual sensibility that Zappa was trying to express in his various kinds.
Well, one could find it an amazing artistic decision on Zappa and Beefheart's part, or you could see it simply as a quite direct reflection of their environment, that maybe they threw off a whole lot of prejudices and assumptions about what's artistic or what's nice. I mean, the music they grew up with said the beach was the cool place. I mean, that was their first white pop music that affected them was beach music. What do you call it? Surf rock. And they're just this special zone is considered pleasurable, and the rest of society is kind of just boring. You know, that's not where you want to be. So, there might be something special about their openness to the environment. But what interests me is the more I think about Zappa, the more I'm thinking about America after the war and fast food and the car are the basis of the society. So I end up thinking about the society as a whole, having been helped, led into it by Zappa and Beefheart. But it's not an artificial, artistic creation on their part. It is a pointing out just what's there.
Yeah, I think it's Uncle Meat, there's that interlude where it sounds like Zappa's carving something. You remember that little sound bite, that section? Where he's scraping, and it's like two metals, and he's scraping something. It's just very evocative. Do you remember that?
Where?
Or maybe it's on one of the, maybe on Uncle Meat, but maybe it's in that period. And this carving thing, and then and the fact he was called Mother Inventions, and he would show that that weird vacuum thing, definitely Zappa, and then all those nuts and bolts on the cover of Burnt Wendy's Sandwich. Definitely Zappa was pointing out what for McLuhan would be a cliche thing. McLuhan would say that Zappa was a replay by the android meme of the sensibilities that Joyce Lewis and other guys in the radical modernist movement were pointing to. So I don't think Zappa was not making... if he was trying to give a message, but then it's hard to tell because Kalshenko might have been projecting that. You know, I'm not sure. It's like the aesthetic message about the medium, the technology is molding our new music and our sensibility. That's a message from the first half of the 20th century.
But it's like pop art with a worker in it. That pop art is seamless and about commodity products, but with Zappa and Beefheart, you feel the judder of the machinery of labor. You feel the tiredness of muscles. You feel something affecting you physically. It's not simply something you eyeball and appreciate the airbrush curves on something or the fins on the car from the outside. That it enters into the physical action of doing things, and Zappa delights in that, and his aesthetic of beauty is never of something that merely is pretty for the eye. It's always about doing something, which is what the scraping you're talking about is about. That he always foregrounds the fact that it's a needle scraping through a groove, that there's tape scraping by magnets that makes the sound. That for him that physical activity is the life process. And in The Torture Never Stops, you have a graphic picture of the body's processes. That it's the what you fall into when you fall asleep, when you lose the concepts which are closer to the contemplation of beautiful objects just given to your eye, and you enter into the processual part of what life activity is. Yeah, and this is where I'd say that Marx's vocabulary is very useful, and I don't think he's been superseded by McLuhan. That Marx's comes from a bohemian and artistic revolt against the sterility and asceticism of the bourgeois culture he's born into, and this enthusiasm for understanding that capitalism turns labor into a chore and something that destroys you and has nothing to do with you, but understanding that nevertheless activity and labor is the thing which creates everything and is the real part of being human. And as far as I can see, this actually outwits all the assumptions of postmodernism about transcending the material world and becoming just a mind, you know, the huge idealism which we've had in the 80s and 90s. So I think Marx still has a point to make there.
Right, and so I was thinking, I started to come back in a few minutes ago, I wanted to say that, yeah, Zappa is showing the, not the eye, but the proprioceptive in terms of inner muscular tension and the tactile.
The hands that come in. I mean,
edges and rubbing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he's tactile proprioceptive music and the process of doing it. He's totally involved in it. And that's the worker.
It's also the element of parody in the music, that you're very aware that it is people beating things and chugging and churning, you know, that it's and that this produces a comic element.
That's right. He says in one of his first interviews in the New York Times, like around 66, he says, "We don't know who's really playing the drums in our band." It's a great line, and it really points to what you just said. Now, let's go on to McLuhan. You continue your email. McLuhan's words about theater. Now, that's it's not McLuhan's. He's inveighing against what Brecht would call bourgeois realism. And then you're saying they come alive in the context of the Goodman footage. You mean that what Yeats is pointing to, the motion multitude, we see in the Goodman footage, right?
Yeah.
Then you say New World classicism scores a point. Is that a technical category from Cambridge Literary?
No, it's not. It's something I just made up because it's something I'm still not found the right phrase for yet, actually. It's something that just occurs to me. What I meant was that the concentration on the classical sources, you use the word manipian, which comes from ancient Greece, paying attention to stuffy things like French drama, paying attention to those literary things, produces, this is rubbing it up because it rubs the wrong way against new media, produces these insights. So that's what I was pointing out, that McLuhan is doing this thing where suddenly talking about these quiet kind of almost fuddy-duddy stuff, you know, suddenly produces the insight into the very modern things that we want to understand.
Right. I thought New World Classicism, looking at the phrase, New World, that'd be the United States or America.
Well, I had to say that. I couldn't quite say America.
Would be the Bible? The gospel is New World Classicism?
No. I had to say New World because McLuhan is strictly a Canadian, isn't he? He's not American. So then you start saying North American and you ways round that.
That's why I said classicism, Manipian satire.
I mean, yeah, knowing your classical authors, Aeschylus, and then on into Shakespeare, Racine, Moliere, the kind of authors that Yeats is talking about.
Yeah, did you know that Joyce said that he was a classical writer?
Well, yes.
He said that.
Yeah, I mean, this is what hearing the Elvis sped up did for me. It made me realize that the choice between living expression and seeing your expression as a something from a dead culture, which is what classicism is. It's when you appreciate statues and marble buildings left from a culture which is no longer there, and can produce an attitude that the only thing worth doing now is to do something that will speak to people in 2,000 years' time. But the contrast between that and somebody who believes in a living communication is that this standoff is highly undialectical and stupid, because every time you do a convincing communication to anybody, if you look at it as a formal construction, it allows you to tune and make more hard and spiky what you want to communicate. And that the whole business of that Zappa and BFARP were involved in, of being so aware of what records were and making records, and the dynamic between something that happens live in real time and then gets frozen onto something which you can repeat and look at as an object. This dynamic happens all the time with artists, and it's making sure that that dynamic keeps rebounding and going from one to the other, which is the intelligence of art. And therefore, standoffs where you're choosing between one or the other seem to me to stop this movement from one to the other.
Okay, look at this phrase, New World Classicism. Classicism can refer to the Greek culture, the Greek chorus, or it can refer to French plays, you know, 2,000 years later. This is the issue here. What is classic? So you would use the acoustic classic versus the visual classic. So the literary visual classic of the French versus the acoustic semi-literate classics of the Greek culture. Does that help clarify what you're trying to get at with New World Classicism?
No, I've got lost in the phrase. Maybe the phrase wasn't well formulated, Bob. Maybe we should erase it.
Okay, well, let's just say, what the heck? You're saying New World Classicism scores a point. What scores a point? What are you talking about?
I mean, I thought it was McLuhan, but it was Yeats, so it wasn't New World anyway.
Right.
But,
so you're talking about the Yeats quote, you're impressed with the quote, and you're impressed with what Yeats is pointing out.
Yeah, I'm impressed with someone who can analyze literature, which I'm calling classicism, maybe was the wrong word, and observe big changes. They're able to look at, say, 18th century French drama and say, hey, the chorus from the Greeks is missing. There's some element of the masses which is not being included here, of the society speaking. We only have individuals. Something's been lost. And it's this kind of intent to speak grandly about what we're talking about, which I missed when I went to study English, where I got people who are incredibly hostile to any statements of that nature, who always, and it's very easy for them to do it since they were older than you and had read more books, always pointed out that you didn't really know what you were talking about. You shouldn't make generalities and you shouldn't think in this way. And I think thinking in this way is the only point. The comparing whole civilizations and seeing what gets left out and thinking how we live, that if we don't do that, then there's no point in going and reading books in the first place. I don't understand why people do it, but people do it because then they become experts and they can keep people off their field, but actually they're not understanding anything.
It's a war between the book and the newspaper. People experience the whole global perspective every day when they read the newspaper because news items are from all over the world. I mean, this is, you know, 50 years ago, and you're getting the images of different cultures. So the collage effect of radical modernist art is right there in your newspaper. So then the old book medium through university, it objects to that and counters it with this hyper-specialism. You see my point?
Well, I mean, it has its... drawbacks, but on the other hand, the newspaper without any reflection creates its own problems. So what I'm interested in is how we get the reflection on what is produced by the newspaper situation, which isn't merely defensive of book culture, but can bring things to bring enlightenment to bear, because the TV news and newspaper news seems to enforce a kind of apartness from what you're feeling and what you're observing, in which somehow the only thing you can do is you put a few pounds into a little pouch which goes off to Haiti, and that kind of solves your little problem of the day of having seen these horrible images, and prevents people living in a way which is creating new ways of behaving that I think are possible given the technical and educational level that we've all got to.
Right, and who solves that problem? Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake takes the newspaper panorama and puts it into book form, and then even goes deeper into the electronic effects of media past the newspaper. So that was McLuhan's point, is how Finnegan's Wake solved the problem of how to present what's happening and yet refer back to previous environment and values. You see? You get that? Can you see what I'm saying right there?
Yeah, but what do you do with somebody who says, well, I mean, Finnegan's Wake might knock you out as individual phrases which support your crazy theories, Bob, and maybe there's a certain music in the language which is very powerful, but it's an evasion of... The concrete reality that I'm getting from the newspaper. I'm kind of sticking my head, it's like Wagner. I'm, swimming in very powerful art, but it's like a drug.
Okay, when you read, if I show someone Finnegan's Wake and they say, I can't read that, I say, well, look, treat it as a newspaper. When you read a newspaper, you just glance here and you go through pages over and you look at that picture or this and that and you jump around and you get little glimpses. That experience is what's being presented in the book form, but you're fooled by the form of the book. And you think you got to treat it like a book. And Joyce fools you because he presents the newspaper's content and you think that's a lousy book or disorderly book. He's showing you the actual media experience you do every day when you read the newspaper, right there in the book form. See, it's the level of forms, not the phrases and quotes. I'm talking on the level of forms that Joyce is contrasting there. And of course, he's making fun, it's manipulative, because he knows people won't recognize that's what it is. They won't recognize that it's radio. As McLuhan would say, Finnegan's Wake's not a book, it's a radio program. Well, also is there the scanning gaze of the newspaper reader and the movie viewer. So that's an important point to appreciate what was really being pointed out by radical modernism.
Well, you see, I see it as a depiction of the state of the body while all this stuff is happening.
So real body is registering the body's responses as well as other media's responses.
Yeah.
Your body is not limited to your chemical body. He's including your radio body and your newspaper and literate body, which are extensions of your senses, which comes to the next line in your email, which is really good. You go, Bob, we could rewrite the book on pop culture and world literature. Invent an aesthetic / politics that could truly deal with our unsaid senses. Very good phrase, Ben. Unsaid senses is what McLuhan is pointing to.
Well, yeah.
That's our extended senses. And we don't know how to describe them. And Joyce tried to describe and show the extended senses, and it looks like a book that's not saying anything particular because he's pointing out the unsaid senses. The senses are there. So you hit on a very important phrase for us over here in the McLuhan Fortress.
Well, you're clarifying for me that for both of us, all this stuff that we've absorbed and pursued, I mean, you don't become a Zappa fan easily. You know, it's in opposition to a lot of your friends who don't like the records, and then you have to go and find them, and you pursue it. You know, you went to libraries in Britain in order to look up his interviews with
interviews with
Frank Zappa, and to find out exactly what he said at each time. So we've chewed on this stuff, and I feel like we've chewed on the right stuff to sharpen our teeth. You know, we've got very sharp teeth, having chewed on Finnegan's Wake and Frank Zappa.
Great metaphor. Look at the cover of Uncle Meek.
But now we have these sharp teeth, Bob.
So it totally fits. But the dental hygiene dilemma.
That's right. But it's what are we going to bite on? You know, it's like
Bert Whitney sandwiches is a tasty sucker, and he's biting
a tire. He's biting a tire. Yeah, exactly. Where are the tires? I mean, where are the what is there to bite on? And that's what I find quite difficult to find, is to find an area where people will care that I've bitten in, because everything's got so niche marketed and separated, and every stroke is good for some folk, and nobody must criticize anybody else's nice time, and everybody can study the sounds on records and reproduce them, and you know, mechanically kind of artificially get spray on soul and passion and rock fury, and all this stuff can be managed now. And I want to know where to put my teeth in, where it's going to hurt, you know?
Well, you get at it with the rest of the sentence. You say, our aesthetics politics could truly deal with our unsaid senses trembling on the brink of the virtual global sensorium. And I thought you must have, you know, grit your teeth when you wrote virtual global sensorium, because that sounds postmodern and you not want to go that way. But you're acknowledging it's there. We're broadcasting on the brink of the virtual global sensorium, because anybody can hear us at any time. And where are we?
Well, I'm interested in that poking the finger into the global sensorium and producing a ripple on the surface, which allows people to see that it is a glossy surface they're looking at, and that they're not actually looking through to reality. You know, it's kind of almost muddying the waters on purpose in the right places. I mean, this is a lot of bad avant-garde art has made a fetish of muddying the waters, and I really disagree with it. I think I like clarity and knowing what I'm doing, and I don't believe in creating confusion for its own sake. But I do think there's an interruption to the sense of obviousness which we get, that the media work on the idea that it's all obvious, that they're there and you're here and they're telling you things, and it's all completely unobvious. As soon as you're in a TV studio and you sweat under the lights and you go in, it's such a kind of cardboard, you know, sort of silly show that everyone's doing. There's so much that's not said in front of the speakers, and all the real deals about money and fame and all the real jokes and all the real life is omitted from the screen.
I got 2 points, Ben. I'm going to respond to that, but first to go back. Since literacy brought in the ability to read books by yourself and in the silence, and it brought created the environment for Henry VIII to create the Protestant religion, it's interesting about the dullness of the Protestant hymnal singing is because they were miming the initial new privacy that the printed book brought in, and the quiet and dull silent thing permeated their music. You can look at that as an effect of the printing press, which their religion, the Protestant religion, was built on.
That's a great explanation of why, after experiencing Muddy Waters and the Rolling Stones, I can't stand church services in England. I mean, that's a fantastic historical materialist explanation. Thanks for that.
Okay, good. I wanted to say that about half an hour ago, so I'm glad I just waited. Now, the other point is, And what was it you were just saying? The other thing is
poking our finger in, making a ripple in the whether the screen is a surface we should interrupt, or whether it's a portal on a real world.
Okay, it's close, but I'm just going to have to jump around until I get it. I got it. McLuhan wrote to Ezra Pound in 1951 about acknowledging the demands and revolution Pound had to do aesthetically for his time. But McLuhan says, today, words are our drug. And I'm working on that point. See, what happened? I'm working on that problem, he said. Now, when you talk about how the TV broadcasters tell you what's happening, this and that, they're using the English language, or in any country, any verbal language, and it's such a puny medium compared to all the post-verbal and paraverbal media that's going on. That's what you're unhappy with. You're unhappy with these stupid, literate, mouth, local-centric just utterances, or banal utterances, but they're limiting it to the mouth, and they think the mouth can control everything. It's when McLuhan says the word makes the market. That's a fascist situation. When you take the statements that are coming under Davos today, you know, in Switzerland, these verbal statements about a very complex Finnegan-Wake environment, the statements are irrelevant and puny. And so that's where you get into a problem. You, Ben, when you celebrate the textures of speech, when it's in a world of word as a drug, but you try to get past the meaning, semantic interpretation of the word as drug, and bring it in as a pleasure device, you know, spattering and licking and slurping, to show the mouth as an aesthetic thing beyond the meaning. But you're still operating within the mouth dynamic. And I got no problem with that. But in relation to what I see as the virtual global sensorium and the unsaid, see the unsaid senses, the unmouthed senses, we got new senses. It's that we're trying to replay.
But there's an appropriate action to do in different contexts. So,
yes, that's a good point.
There are, I'm not proposing my mouth poems as the solution to world hunger, but I am saying that they need to be included if you are using a microphone and talking on the radio. You know, that's one place where it seems appropriate. Or if you're doing poetry, you need to admit that you actually do have lips.
You're actually, with the mumblings of you and Mordecai, creating the emotion of the multitude on a micro level.
Yeah. And that's what I feel I can do at the moment, but that doesn't stop me being ambitious or trying to think what we could do in a different ways, using different technologies to carry the same intent across more powerfully in different areas. So I'm listening.
Yeah, in a way, we are an anti-environment to the Out to Lunch show, because we actually try to use the mouth to swallow all that's going on with our bizarre allusions to Zappa, Joyce Lewis, and McLuhan and Marx. We collage, but we're trying to be, quote, rational in a way.
Well, we're trying to understand it, yeah. Yeah.
We're actually, I don't think there's a, well, we know what we're talking about. No one else in the world could talk about it. Don't know the relevance of it, and just doing that is a bizarre anti-environment to everything. You know what I mean? Because we are making a point that no one could deny if they made the effort to understand what we're saying. We're talking, quote, truth here, the truth of our situation, of what communication is, what the old forms of communication. We're new world, and we're new universe classicists. We actually dare to use our mouth to explain and to criticize all the faulty mouthings going on all over the place.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. Now, that's just one little project. The ongoing project of the Revelation Revolution is being an example of staying alive and perceptive of what most people can't take in anymore because they stopped. See, you and I, Ben, we have not stopped perceiving and looking for something, quote, new.
Yeah.
And we include all the struggles of the past. So it's a big now we're living in. A big now.
Yeah, well, we're trying to be responsible about the past, and we're interested in, you know, Yeats on French drama and the ancient Greeks and the differences. But we know that those things only come alive if they relate directly and at once to the immediate situation we're in now. Skyping each other across the world, or whatever we're doing, contributing in this way to some kind of global talk. And we want those two things to become the same thing. We don't want them to be separated anymore.
We're not depending on our knowledge. We're not flashing our knowledge in the eyes of others. We're maintaining the I don't know level.
We've sabotaged our authority as people. I mean, you sabotage it with your preposterous claims and your experiments with telepathy and so on. We are sabotaging, and I sabotage it with my cantankerous insistence on a few favourite records all the time. It annoys everybody. And so we have no position within the world that we don't like. And that's very important. That's a point that Guy Debord used to make. If you have a position to defend within the structure you're trying to bring down, then, of course, you're going to defend it. And we don't. So we have a kind of purity, Bob.
That's right. And an example is the Vessel Goodman clip. My friend J.W., who channels Ion, he grew up in Georgia. He thinks he was conceived, his parents conceived, listening to Vessel Goodman. You know, that's the culture he comes out of. And he sent me these clips, and he said later, he said, I'll send these to Bob. He'll probably just laugh them off. He was shocked that I was so amazed by him that I wanted to hear everything about Vestal. And he spent the next hour when I called him back telling me the whole history of Vestal and all the whole culture and other YouTubes. And he was amazed.
It's great. And we'll have to end there because we've run out of time. But on top of all the things we're saying, we're gospel fans.
Yes. Great. Vestal Zappa.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, man.